serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is Murray Lee, a 91-year-old World War II veteran who served in the Merchant Marines. Nearly a quarter million Americans served in the Merchant Marines, and nearly 10,000 of them were killed. One out of every 26 men in the Merchant Marines never came home. That's the highest ratio of any branch of service in World War II. Murray was also one of approximately 20,000 Chinese Americans who served in our armed forces during the war, and he has captured individual stories of Chinese American vets in his book, Through the Eyes of Heroes, which you can link to at hometownheroesradio.com. What have you learned, Murray, about the contribution of Chinese Americans in World War II?
I know that researching, interviewing a lot of the Chinese Americans here in San Diego, I ran across quite a number of them that had been sent to China, Western China, where Chiang Kai-shek was still in operation in that area. They went to support the Flying Tigers in that area, those areas. They didn't just end up in Kunming or in one city because they wanted to make it difficult for the Japanese to locate these forces where they were, so they went around to various small towns in that area and established a base, you know, kind of scattered around. So they weren't all together, although at one time, then when they left, they all sort of ended up coming all together, and when they were sent back to the U.S., they gathered up in one area, and some of them said, oh, you have the opportunity, this is when the war was over there, of going down and visiting your home villages back in Canton, Guangdong area, or you can go straight back to the West Coast in the U.S., and some of them decided to take advantage of that and go and visit their home villages and that.
And even in your own family, you had a couple half-brothers who were doing interesting things during World War II.
They were the first Chinese after Pearl Harbor. They're written up in the newspaper, and there's a picture of them. They were in New York at that time. They joined right after Pearl Harbor. They ended up in the U.S. Air Force. One brother, the older one, went to Europe and was based in England and flew with medium bombers 50 missions over enemy territory in France and Germany. When he came back after those 50 missions, and I just can't believe this, because if you have 50 missions and you don't get wounded, you ought to quit. Because that was required. He went and joined the RAF and flew in their medium bombers, which were wooden bombers at that time. Everybody thought, well, you're crazy. But anyway, he did that. He loved flying, I guess. And the other brother was flying the hump. We supported Chiang Kai-shek and the troops in Kunming and those areas by bringing in supplies from India. They had to go over the Himalayas. That was nothing easy because these two-engine planes, some of them had a lot of trouble. So he was flying back from China to go back to India to get more supplies than that. The engine faltered on this plane, and they all bailed out, and they bailed out over Burma. The pilot just kept the plane going, sacrificed his life so that everybody got out, and he crashed with the plane, so he was the only casualty out of that, but quite a hero in himself. So they landed in this headhunter country in Burma with a tribe that normally probably would have lost their heads. But this tribe hated the Japanese because the Japanese were invading Burma from the south. And so they said, well, we will walk you guys back through the jungle to India, which was quite a number of days. And so my brother was on that, and they reported that he had a sprained ankle. Some of them had more serious injuries, but he is mentioned by Eric Severide, who was on that plane, famous correspondent, war correspondent. And so I have this story, and he wrote this all up in the Reader's Digest, and I thought it's a very interesting story. Story about that. And so they did make it back to India, and where they would be able to continue on and get other planes and get back to flying the hump again. So that's his story.
Well, and in this book, Through the Eyes of Heroes, you have many more Chinese American veterans who you have interviewed and gotten their story. Some of them are no longer with us. Do you think that the general public has a sense of the contributions of Chinese Americans during World War II?
No, I don't. Maybe even some of the Chinese don't. But that was the whole purpose of this, is to get these interviews of Chinese Americans. They were in various units, from Navy to Marines to Army and all of those. Some of them knew each other, others may not have, but They all were based here in San Diego, and we had quite a number of Chinese Americans that joined. And a lot of them, when the war was declared, they were in San Diego High School. And all the Chinese that lived in Chinatown went to San Diego High School. That was the only high school, I think, in the area. A lot of them just immediately signed up. But anyway, accumulating all their stories was a major contribution, I think, to the history of Chinese in San Diego.
Well, and I know it's probably hard to pick just one, but is there one story that you came across in putting this book together that just raises your eyebrows or says, wow, that is a hero? I mean, you call it Through the Eyes of Heroes. Who's a hero in this book in your mind?
One of them that I did interview, and that's Gorman Fong. I think that his family's going to have his plaque put up on Mount Soledad, hopefully very soon. I encouraged all of them to do that, and I think one of his sons said, well, I'm going to get it and put it up there. I interviewed him. He had a very interesting story about how he was with this field artillery battalion in 1944. The one big thing that happened to him was in the Battle of the Bulge. Well, Hitler would just told him, go in there, we might lose this war, but we want to drive these guys back to the ocean. They got all their panzer divisions, and they started going back to force all these Americans and British back to where they landed, you know. He was stationed in one place which was right on their route where they were going to be going through. And so he said, well, they considered him a sacrifice unit there. What's that famous correspondent mentioned about him that they figured that they were gone? Ernie Pyle wrote in the Stars and Stripes that we were already dead. In other words, presumed dead because we were our sacrifice battery. We saw the colonel and his assistant sitting in their jeep, ready to pull out on the highway, and we were seeing all these foot soldiers marching back carrying their guns. We hear all the rumbling sound of tanks only about a half mile away. We hear these sounds. It was at night. We asked some of those soldiers, hey guys, what's up there? They answered, the Germans are coming right at us. We have a few guns holding them back right now, and you guys will be the last line of defense. Then our marching orders were given to us that could not leave until 0100. By then, the Germans had overrun the position we were in. So that's why we were presumed that we were already dead. We just had the two big guns, 155 howitzers to cover, and 50 caliber machine guns, one on each side of the road. Everybody is going crazy. Nobody wanted to die. They might wonder why we were designated to hold, but our gun positions just happened to be each side of the road. We were just happy to get out alive. So the German panzers were so fast, they just bypassed him. They didn't want to bother with him. And afterwards, he ended up going to Berlin after, you know, we had won that war. He was in Berlin. One of his fellow Americans who was examining a German Luger automatic pistol, while he was doing that, the gun went off and shot Gorman in the leg. And I told Gorman, I said, did you get the Purple Heart for that? He said, no, I didn't get the Purple Heart. I said, yeah, but you were wounded by a German gun, weren't you? I said, you should have gotten a Purple Heart. And there were Chinese in North Africa and in Italy and other places. We have one Chinese in here. His name was Victor Schoon, S-C-H-O-O-N. They never allowed Chinese to fly. They couldn't be pilots. That's a discrimination that they had. They always be tail gunners or something like that. But he ended up being captain of a B-17, flying 50 missions out of Italy. And how did he get that? Because they thought he was German. He had his name Schoon, S-C-H-O-O-N, and that was a name given to his father when he came into the country. They would come in and the immigration office would say, oh, I can't pronounce your Chinese name. I'm just going to call you Schoon. This guy was German, I think. And so they thought he was German, so he became a pilot. And once he became a pilot, they couldn't do much about it. But later on, after he came out of the military, he and his wife were trying to go to a military function in this country, and they wouldn't let him go in. Here this guy was flying 50 missions as a B-17 pilot, and then he goes to an event there, and they look at him and say, oh, you and your wife are Chinese. You know, you can't come in here.
I guess I need to ask you, too. You know, and we've talked to so many Japanese Americans on this program who certainly faced discrimination, were locked behind barbed wire during this period. But I've heard stories of Chinese Americans being mistaken for Japanese and treated accordingly, given what was happening at the time. Did you run across any anecdotes like that?
Yes, a number of people said, oh, you know, when all this happened, we were walking around the streets and that, and we would wear these little notes on our jacket, you know, I am Chinese, because a lot of people can't tell the difference between Chinese and Japanese. They saw any Asian walking around might be Japanese, and if they saw you and thought you were Japanese, they might beat you up in that. But the Chinese and Japanese did live in an area together before the war. There was a part of San Diego's Chinatown, they called it Fifth and Island, were the same as Japantown. A lot of the Chinese knew the Japanese. In fact, they used to trade stuff together and got along fairly well. And when they interned all these Japanese, some of the Chinese would maybe took over some of those businesses and say, we'll run this place while you're gone, and maybe when you come back, you can take it back. But they did go around with notes on there afterwards when people would look at them and think they were Japanese.
And there's this effort to secure the Congressional Gold Medal. Now, that's happened for Japanese Americans. It's happened for female pilots. It's happened for African American servicemen in World War II. A lot of these different groups have received that Congressional Gold Medal. If it were to be awarded to Chinese American veterans of World War II, which would include you, what would that mean to you?
Well, it would be quite an honor, I think. It's not like any of these guys have not gotten medals, but that's quite a medal, I think. This medal is one of the top of the, and it's nice to get it if you're alive and worth it.
So don't wait too long, Congress, right?
Because, you know, there's just not many left.
Well, if there's anything else that you want to share, feel free. And I want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for all your efforts in preserving history here. Is there something you would say that you want people who read these books to understand, that there's a message you want to convey or communicate that you hope people will hold on to?
Well, I think that after so many years of discrimination, exclusion, and that to show that the Chinese Americans are Americans, as well as having Chinese ancestry, that they're Americans and that they are willing to fight for their country and to defend it.
And I get the sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think you've recorded these stories and put them in print just to bemoan the past. I have the sense you see a value in telling these stories to inform the future and make sure that injustices like this never take place again?
Of course, yes. I think the more that people know about what the contribution of the Chinese made to the building of this country and fighting in during the war, and that is an example of we're a part of America.
I got one more question. I know you're looking forward, not back. You're working on another book right now. But at 91 years old, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
That I'm still alive. I have a plaque up at Mount Soledad, and I'm very proud that I got that up there, because I'm one of the first Chinese in this group here to get one up there, and I've been encouraging others, you should do that. We should have a little section up there where there are Chinese-American war vets, because there weren't any before I had mine put up there.
And you can find a picture of Murray next to that plaque he's talking about at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. All the books are linked there as well. The Mount Soledad National Veterans Memorial is an amazing spot with spectacular views in every direction. You could really spend an entire day there soaking in those views and digesting the contributions of the men and women whose military service is honored there. I try to visit every time I'm in San Diego, and I have a link to the memorial online for you as well, but we're out of time today. Thanks to Murray Lee for sharing his unique journey with us today, and thank you for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.